From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, Kerry left behind her Russian lover in Paris for New York and Mr. Big. At bars and in millions of homes, Sex and the City fans said goodbye this weekend to a show whose four 30-something-plus bold single women talked frankly about sex, relationships, and dating disasters. There was prim Charlotte, driven Miranda, sexy Samantha, and smart yet vulnerable Kerry. They had nerve, glamour, vulnerability, killer stilettos, and problems to overcome.
I don't like dachshunds for men. Can't handle a real dog, can't handle a real woman.
But he was gorgeous.
And that's another thing. Men who are too good looking, they're never good in bed because they never had to be.
What'd you do last night?
Went to a movie. Oh.
With who?
Myself.
On date night? Are we still going to have to call it date night in our 50s?
I would just think that all the people would be looking at me thinking that poor, pathetic girl.
Kind of like the way I'm looking at you right now.
What?
You don't go out alone?
On date night?
You're never alone in New York. It's the perfect place to be single. The city is your date.
You're dating the city?
About 18 years. It's getting serious. I think I'm in love.
I'm really sorry this happened to you on your first date back out there. But you have to keep trying.
No, I'm like Punxsutawney Phil. I came out, I saw my shadow, and I'm going back in. I'll see you guys next winter.
Well, you have to take some risks so that you don't wind up an old maid.
Oh, that's right. Must not wind up old maid. Must not wind up old maid. Now, how am I going to remember that? Does anybody have a pen?
Sex and the City fans got to sit in on the foursomes get-togethers at New York City restaurants and coffee shops and hear the often very detailed lowdowns on dates gone terribly wrong and promising new men on the horizon, on life crises and absurd predicaments. There were sometimes shocking, sometimes traditional, and judging by the numbers, very entertaining evenings. Tonight on Point, six seasons of Sex and the City and America's changing relationship with bold, independent, high-heel-obsessed women. Were you a Sex and the City addict? Was it good for you? What made you tune in? And now that it's over, what did it all mean? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is L.S. Kim, Assistant Professor of Film and Digital Media at the University of California in Santa Cruz. She has used episodes of Sex and the City in her film classes to discuss sex and feminism in the media. Good evening and welcome, L.S. Kim.
Hello, Tom. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you. So did you watch last night?
Of course I watched.
And? Worthy? Unworthy? How was the ending?
I think it's a question among many viewers whether they were satisfied with the ending or not. Clearly there's a lot of sadness about the close of the show. But what I think about is television is a medium of open narratives, which means that it's never supposed to end. And so in some ways, I think the ending was a non-ending. And that is what keeps the viewers tied to the show. Of course, we've heard talk that there's going to be a movie as well.
The market goes on and on. L.S. Kim, a lot of our listeners will have seen Sex and the City one way or another, either on HBO or on the DVDs and videos that have been out for a while. Now, others may never have seen it. You're the film buff. Would you be good enough to kind of capsulize the story, the narrative drift of Sex and the City? What was it all about?
Sure. The program began in 1998 on HBO, and Sex and the City is a program that centers, as you said, on the lives and loves of four professional women in New York City. I think what viewers are really tuning into after the initial kind of shock factor of the explicit kind of discussions and portrayals of sex and women's sexuality is the friendship that the women shared. So in other words, we were really drawn, myself included, really drawn into the stories of the relationships that women had with men and sometimes other women, but particularly the relationships that they had with each other. So as you mentioned, there are four key characters: Carrie, a writer of a sex column; Miranda, who is an attorney and in some ways began as the prototypical feminist figure; Charlotte is a traditionalist, and throughout the series until the last couple seasons was a true believer in marriage; and then Samantha, who, you know, through her own kind of wild antics procured a lot of laughter but also a lot of discussion about sex, and so she reveled in her own kind of exciting sexual. But I think, you know, again, that while viewers were able to kind of talk about and gossip and laugh about the relationships that the characters had with different people, what kept us watching was the strength of the friendship that the four women had. And certainly throughout the 6 years, the characters, each of them in their own ways, underwent transformations in terms of what they believed about relationships. And what I would argue was consistent is what they believed about themselves and their friendships.
And the evolution was toward more emphasis on friendship, more emphasis on self-examination and looking at their own values and priorities, I guess. I mean, it started out with an awful lot of fluff and sex, and it to some degree got more serious. But in the end, how do you look at this show, L.S. Kim? Was this important? Was it inane? I mean, you had four very affluent women, white women in New York, more affluent, it seemed, than even their professional careers could have possibly supported with these $400 sets of shoes. You know, sometimes very significant issues of friendship and always that deep texture of friendship. But was this an important show?
Well, obviously, I study the text and show it to my students. So to a certain degree, yes, I believe it's an important text, you know, for several reasons. First of all, it was successful. It lasted 6 years. And on its own, the producers decided to end the program. And that's not often how a program goes off the air. So by, you know, the sheer fact that it lasted and, you know, continued to gain an audience, it's culturally significant. But clearly all the questions and the issues about not only women's sexuality, but I think, you know, more broadly and perhaps more importantly, the state of women, independent, single working women in the millennium is really what the program grappled with and what tapped into viewers' interests. And so, you know, to watch for 6 years how the program, through its characters, transformed and yet maintained this ongoing discussion about, you know, in essence, the role of women and the question of marriage in this age.
Yeah, marriage and the pursuit of men, interestingly, was all over this show about women. Maybe that's inevitable, though it's not exactly what we were led to expect by a lot of feminist thinking that came before Sex and the City. L.S. Kim, stand by if you would. I want to welcome also into our conversation Jennifer Frey. She joins us from Dobbs Ferry, New York. She's a television reporter for The Washington Post. Good evening and welcome, Jennifer Frey.
Hi, how are you?
We're great. Thanks a lot for joining us. Jennifer, you watch television and trends in television. Was Sex and the City revolutionary? What set it apart from what came before?
Well, I think Sex was quite different from what you see on television in terms of the way it portrayed women, the way it portrayed women in an ensemble comedy here and the way they interacted with each other. But mostly it was about the risks they would take in showing women in a very realistic way, sometimes negatively, sometimes positively, but almost always in a way where girlfriends would pick up their phone and call and say, that's exactly like X, and they meant a situation in their life, a relationship in their life. And so it did, in a lot of ways, reflect the way women's lives were changing, but sort of the pop culture notion, the, you know, I love her to death as an actress, but the Meg Ryan version of the romantic comedy had been spoon-fed to us. And in this, you know, women had sex and they had relationships and they were messy and they were the wrong guys and they were the right guys, and sometimes the guys didn't matter at all and the friendships mattered more and sometimes the work mattered and sometimes you wanted to have a baby and sometimes you thought it was insane to want to have a baby.
Right.
And it went all over the map, which is much more in tune with the way women think about their lives at this time.
So was it the sex or was it the candor and intimacy of the friendships? What set it apart from what had come before on television, Jennifer?
Well, I don't think all the women who tuned in watched for the sex. They watched for the conversations about the sex afterwards and the way women talked about it with each other and the way they parsed what it meant in their lives, the fact that you could have the freedom to choose to say, I want to see you tonight and I don't want to see you tomorrow. And perhaps that was the old male model of a one-night stand, but a woman could do the same thing. And not necessarily that was the standard of sex on Sex and the City either. It could be that you could get involved in this relationship and be confused about where it stood, and you sit around with your girlfriends and you talk about it in a very explicit way, the sex and the relationship. And I think that's what made it, the coffee shop scenes when the four women got together and rehashed what had happened, often the sex from the night before, were essential to the show, even more so than, you know, Samantha's you know, multitudes of orgasms over the past 2 years.
Right. And there were plenty.
Yes.
I guess I'd ask you both how realistic or how groundbreaking that kind of conversation was. I enjoyed the show. I caught it many times. But I don't sit around with other women in coffee shops talking about last night's sex. Maybe you do. Was this the way women talked about sex? Is it the way they talk about it now, post-Sex and the City? Was it realistic, or was this kind of showing, well, here's how you might talk about sex? Ellis Kim, what do you think?
Well, I think one of the developments out of the program is people realized women do talk about sex, that they like to talk about sex, and in fact are even proud of their sex lives. So it's a certain kind of, you know, demystification of women's sexuality. And to hear the talk in kind of television conversation was something that viewers liked to see reflected.
And for you, what was this? Did this sound like what your real conversations are? I mean, more polished. It's done by writers. It's professional. But I mean, is this? Do you sit with your friends at the coffee shop in Santa Cruz and say, "Whoa, I got a tale for you"?
I think women do talk more about sex than a lot of people realize, particularly men, particularly their parents. But I think the program operates successfully on both fantasy and reality. In other words, you know, as Jennifer says, the women talked about sex. That's what viewers loved to hear, not necessarily to see. And at the same time, the ways in which the, you know, kind of the scenarios broke down were fantastical. And so they were able to hear the kinds of questions and problems being discussed that they experience in their own lives and yet see it play out and represented, right, literally represented in very glamorous and exciting ways.
No kidding. A very, very glamorous setting. So, but Jennifer, let me put that same question to you. When you listened in with the rest of us on these intimate kind of post-game, shall we say, conversations, did you recognize this, or did you see a new way of talking being demonstrated in Sex and the City?
Well, I recognized it from real life. I lived in New York City in my 20s when I was single, and so I recognized it from real life. I didn't. In terms of what you're saying is sort of groundbreaking or new, it was something I hadn't seen on television before. Now, that said, we need to recognize right off the bat that this is a part of the new wave of cable television, specifically HBO, most to the point HBO, making regular television series where they can go outside of the box in the way network television with the FCC rules can't. And so to have the kind of conversations they were having in a sitcom in a regular television show wasn't going to happen on the networks at that point in time. And so it was groundbreaking in terms of what HBO, the levels that HBO went to. Mm-hmm. However, the other part of your question is, yes, I have girlfriends who call me and have questions, you know, conversations like this about what's going on in their personal lives and in their sex lives. And you know, I think it's both different and the same from what you'd call, you know, the locker room talk, because having been a sports writer for the first 9 years of my career, I've heard a lot of locker room talk, a lot of high-level locker room talk, and that's a lot of it is about comparing and bragging and, you know, power trips and all of that. And the women talk about it because they want to explore what happened, and they want to say, well, what do I do about this? Yeah. Or this didn't work, or this is whatever, or, oh, my God, when he said this to me, should I be whatever? Like, they want to have a conversation about it with their girlfriends, just like they want to have a conversation about, you know, the fight they had with their boyfriend yesterday, and he said this to me, and I said that back, and do you think I said the wrong thing?
And you write about TV, you write about TV and track it a lot. Do you think a show like Sex and the City propagates that conversation? Does it give permission? Does it provide vocabulary for I guess women in this case to sort of run with that, or would it? Did it just emerge all on its own? Would it have been the same with or without this HBO show?
Well, I think that what was written on the show reflected what some of the writers on the show were seeing and hearing among the people that they lived and worked and were friends with in New York. Yeah. But I also believe the flip side, which is that for people who perhaps were not as progressive, I don't know what word to really pick, in terms of talking about these things, you put a show like this on the air and women start watching it, and they start watching it in groups, or they start watching it on the telephone with their friends.
And off we go.
And off we go. Yeah.
Jennifer Fry with The Washington Post, L.S. Kim in Santa Cruz, California. Stand by. We're talking about Sex and the City and the country on the other side of a provocative cable series. You can join our conversation. Were you a Sex and the City addict? Was it good for you? And what made you tune in? Now that it's over, what did it all mean? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Sex and the City, the HBO cable show that ended last night after six big seasons, and about America's changing relationship with bold, independent women. My guests tonight are L.S. Kim, assistant professor of film and digital media at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She uses Sex and the City in her classes at University of California, Santa Cruz. We're also joined tonight from New York, or Dobbs Ferry, New York, by Washington Post television reporter Jennifer Fry. You can join the conversation as well on Sex and the City. Were these Carrie, Miranda, Samantha, Charlotte, the new American woman? Was this bold feminism or an old-fashioned roundabout search for romance, for love? And what about the sex, the explicitness, the specificity, the variety? Did Sex and the City change the way you talk with your girlfriends, with your husband, about sex, or was it a guilty Sunday night pleasure for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Barbara's calling from Lincoln, Rhode Island. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
I am the mother of a gay daughter, and I am thrilled to say that I loved Sex and the City. I thought it was one of the best programs to ever air on NPR, and I'm sorry that it's gone, but I can appreciate why it is gone.
So you really loved it. Why did you love it so much, Barbara?
Why? Because I thought it left at the apex of its popularity. And I can appreciate that.
But Barbara, your phone line's a little rough, but I appreciate your call. Thanks for calling. L.S. Kim, let me put that to you. Here's a fan. Like, she loved it. She's sorry that it ended. Did you see in your students, in your peers, that kind of attachment to the show?
Oh, I mean, I think her fandom is emblematic of the thousands and thousands of mostly women viewers out there who have become addicts to the program. I have read the morning papers today, and there were many, many farewell parties, you know, where women would get together and they watched the show last night. But I think the caller's enthusiasm is representative of the women's pleasure. I mean, Sex and the City is about and for women's pleasure. The television text itself, in some ways, is about women's pleasure. There's a history of television programs that star women protagonists in a way that's different from film. And this program, Sex and the City, reveled in pleasure for and by and about women.
Jennifer Fry, how about yourself? As you watch the way people respond to television shows, was there a different quality to the attachment? I mean, people get attached to all kinds of TV shows. Was this different? And was it the sort of transgressive intimacy of it that made it different?
I think it was different in one very specific way, which is that most of the women who watched it, they would have all these conversations about which character they identified with. I'm Carrie,
right,
or I'm Samantha, or I'm Charlotte. And, you know, they were set up as very distinct, different types of characters. You know, Charlotte, the girl who wants to have the society wedding and the perfect baby and the perfect picture postcard family, and Samantha, who thinks the idea of marriage is a crock and wants to be completely free in her sexuality, and Miranda, whose job is a driving force in her life and who doesn't want to feel guilty about that, and then Carrie, who is a whole bunch of contradictions. But fans love this show because they saw or looked for or identified parts of themselves and their own lives in it, and women in a very intense way. And you know, one of the things they talked about in the pre-show last night was how so many women would come up and say, I'm Carrie,
right,
let me know, you know, tell you. And I think that was something unique in terms of the attachment the fans would have to the show.
And Ellis, I hear you there.
Yes, but I also wanted to add, particularly as the show developed, I think viewers' attachment to the characters morphed from one character to another, and the characters themselves, you know, shifted and changed in their views about relationships or marriage in particular. And so, in other words, unlike other television programs or films where there is kind of a prototypical trope of womanhood, these four represented kind of the conflicted, changing, shifting dispositions. And so we, as viewers, can identify with one particular character, but that might shift because the characters themselves shifted within the span of the 6 years.
So I'm in a Miranda mood tonight, or I'm in a Samantha mood today.
Sure.
You can have it. I want to ask you, L.S. Kim, because you taught this to students who would be, around, in their late teens, early 20s. You must also know older women who watched it. Was there a generational difference in the way people watched and understood and responded to Sex and the City?
As far as I understand, it seems like the strongest fan base, and I will admit I fit the demographic of the program's key fans, right? Working women in their 30s and 40s. And so there is kind of a direct identification with what the women are going through in their stage in life, specifically dealing with the questions of marriage or motherhood. But I think younger women, and in some ways younger men, my students, are just intrigued with this frank discussion about sex and how those discussions are related to then other life decisions. So in some ways, I've noticed my students don't directly relate, but both the men and the women are really fascinated, and I can show some shocking scenes, and even their 18 and 19-year-old minds are pretty blown away.
Catherine's calling from Boston. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a 17-year-old junior in high school, and I know my friends and I just love and just every Sunday night we'll get together to watch it, and although we might not always be able to relate to them, we almost look up to them, whether it's how they're... Oh, sorry, I've called waiting. But whether it's...
17 and busy on the phone. Catherine, what do you like about it? When you sat with your friends and watched it, you're 17, are you getting a glimpse into the future, or are you just like the candor of the conversation, or what is it? What was it?
It's everything. I mean, yeah, it's a glimpse into the future. I mean, who doesn't want to be Carrie Bradshaw with the awesome clothes, the great friends, the awesome boyfriends, although they're not great all the time. And it's a hilarious show. I mean, you can't help but laugh at everything Samantha says, or the way, like, Miranda makes all those, I don't know, those funny remarks and everything.
Let me ask you, Catherine, and I don't want to be... what did your parents think about it? Did they watch it with you? Did they care?
I first tried to have my mom rent me it for my friends and I.
Yeah.
The ladies at the movie store told her it was soft porn, and she wouldn't get it for us. But I don't know. We convinced.
But your parents came around. I mean, did you watch it with them? I mean, there's some pretty racy stuff there.
I wasn't really interested in that, but I know there's plenty of high schoolers out there. Love the show.
Wow.
Get together and have Sex and City parties. It's great.
It sounds like a lot of them are calling you right now, Catherine. Your call waiting is popping off every direction. Thanks a lot for your call, though. It's great to have it. Jose is calling from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Jose. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Just great, thanks.
Hey, I'm a really great fan of, Sex and the City, and I've been watching it ever since it came out. And I watch it because it's so funny, and I just, sometimes you just hate seeing, everything directed at men, I mean, it just gets really boring. And then when you see this show come on about smart and dependent women in New York and the best place to be, it's just a horror of a time. I watch it with my fiance, and we watch it, and we see it as it is, it's a TV show, it's
sure.
Some parts are very unrealistic and everything, but I think as a whole, and the whole theme of it is about women and relationships with each other.
Jose, let me ask you, when you watched it as a guy and with your fiance there, were you ever, intimidated by the sort of brutal analysis and assessment that these women made with each other of men, of men's personalities, of men's sexuality, of men's sex organs?
Yeah. Well, my mom, she's very intimidating, so I'm already ahead of the game here.
Oh, so you're already fully intimidated. Oh, congratulations.
I know, but if I hear my, you know, if I hear them talking about, you know, penises or something like that, I'm like, oh, you know, like, I feel like kind of weird and everything like that. But, you know, it's a good thing. Maybe, you know, they need to talk about it. They need to put, like, guys down, you know, people, you know, I just like that. I like the frankness of it. And it's sad it's going away, but it's so great that they're going out on top instead of dying
so
off,
to speak.
Like,
on top or on bottom or any place they like to be. Jose, thanks so much for your call from Seattle. Jennifer, what it must have been a thrill to write for this show. I mean, when you think about all the shows that writers could write for, this one must have been an awful lot of fun.
Well, I know the writers on the show, they had Michael Patrick King, who was the head writer, and Darren Star, who's the creator, but they had six women who were all single women who all lived in New York, and they openly admit that some of the scenes, some of the things that happened, getting, you know, Carrie once got broken up with by a guy who left her a Post-it note, or
right,
that they would derive these things from their own girlfriends' lives, or their own lives, and so you get to go through this experience of somewhat living, which you're then going to put on the screen. And I know that, you know, several of the writers were interviewed and talking about how much they had a hard time letting go of it because it had become as much about their own world as about the world they saw on television.
And Ellis, help us out here with some of the moments. You said you show your class some of the moments that just leave their jaws dropping. What did you pick out as some of the real border-crossing moments here when you were watching television, even though cable, even though HBO, and thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm watching this?
Well, usually the scenes involve Samantha, not surprisingly. And at the same time, like the previous caller, the discussion, the actual naming of, you know, male or female body parts, and involving that in a comedic scene, for example, is a way in which, on one hand, just the topic of sexuality is there. But I think what is shocking is not the images. It's the fact that a woman is speaking about it. So, you know, talking about the writers and how six of the key writers were women and drawing from their own lives. I think that's what really got viewers so interested, whether they were aware or not that the writers were writing from their real lives. Because to be able to talk about your own story or your own stories is something that the television program kind of, you know, keyed in on. And so the scene, there's a scene with Samantha who has met an older gentleman who was having lunch with Donald Trump. And so Trump made a cameo appearance, and she begins a relationship with this older gentleman. Her friends kind of guffaw, and basically she kind of assesses what it's like, you know, to be with an older man. She says, you know, the romance is the same, you know, the meals and the seduction is the same, but then they show the man standing up, undressed. He turns around, and she says, "But the derriere is not the same." She used a different word, an HBO-rated word.
Gravity takes its toll.
That's right.
On everybody. I want to turn again to Seattle. We're joined there now by Rebecca Denk. She's general manager of Toys in Babeland. It's a sex toy chain run by women. Good evening and welcome, Rebecca Denk.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, thanks for joining us. Rebecca, it's funny how after all these years of watching Sex and the City on television, you put things in a different context and you can hear how everybody's kind of edging around the sexual stuff, even after it's out there all this time. You're in the business of sex and sex toys. Did you see any kind of crossover in real life between Sex and the City and your business?
Oh, certainly. I can specifically remember customers coming to the store and still do, asking for the rabbit by name, which is a product that Charlotte became enamored of in season one. So
this was the rampant rabbit, the famous vibrator that Charlotte could not get enough of.
Exactly. I think her friends had an intervention for her, but we still have customers coming in asking for that specific product. So I think that Sex and the City did a lot to normalize women's discussions of sex and their expectations of pleasure and how they can pursue that on their own.
So when you look back over, I don't know how old Toys in Babeland is, but it's a kind of a breakthrough business in itself. Do you see a real change in the last half dozen years in women's willingness to dive into their sexuality in a more open, more public way, talk with their friends about it, be more adventurous?
I believe so. Toys in Babeland has been around for 10 years and was founded by two friends that were looking for somewhere to shop, essentially. And so it came out of women empowering themselves to find these products. But over, you know, the last 4 years, we've seen incredible growth. We have two stores in New York, and we've seen average of 21% growth in our New York stores. And then we have one store in Seattle that's had an average of 15% growth over those 4 years, and then 87% growth in our Babeland.com online website. So it's amazing that so many more women, I think, we define that as our primary demographic, are finding these products for themselves and are coming out of the closet. Like, sex toys aren't just staying in the bedside table drawer anymore.
And maybe some of that candor complements of Sex and the City. Let me ask you this, Rebecca, because you work in this world. On the one hand, Sex and the City celebrated a kind of freedom and women's empowerment in relationship to sex. On the other hand, we know we live in a kind of paranoid age about sex that wasn't, at least in my viewing, wasn't all that often represented on Sex and the City. Issues about health and sexual disease and all that. What was your sense of the way that Sex and the City held sex in mind? Was it, did it match up with what you see with real women there? Not only their desires, but their fears and their concerns about, you know, all the problems that are out there.
I think that's a good observation. My experience definitely is that women talk to their girlfriends about all kinds of things, especially their fears and their relationships and their and confronting sexual problems. So in that way, I think Sex and the City was right on. Of course, it would have been great to have more kind of realistic discussions about, you know, safer sex and STDs and that kind of thing. But I think just breaking the ground and normalizing these discussions was really important. One other trend that I think is really interesting is that women are coming into the shop more and more often in groups, which when we started, it was sort of the lone ladies or couples coming in. And now we're seeing many more kind of groups of friends, like, discussing sex together and shopping for, you know, sexual devices together. It's amazing.
So it's a friend thing. Sex is almost a party.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, there's a trend. Rebecca Denk, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Rebecca Denk is general manager of Toys in Babeland, sex toy chain run by women, and they have seen their business grow in the same years of Sex and the City. Jennifer Frey, what do you make of that? Are you willing to give credit to this show for kind of loosening up the conversation or the I don't know, courage of women to be out there about sexuality?
Well, I don't know if I would give all the credit to the show, but I certainly think that putting it out there in the lexicon and having this weekly conversation about it, so to speak, that women got together and watched, would certainly increase the amount of conversation that women would have with each other. And then, oh, you know, just as she was just saying, oh, let's all go to the pleasure place together to you know, mention the shop here in Washington that is of the same sort of vein at this point. And so I think that there was some, you know, some sort of destigmatization, perhaps. I mean, it was cool after it was on HBO.
Right.
I mean, I think that, as I said before, there were a lot of these conversations that were going on among women and their friends, especially in urban areas and places like New York. But I think when it became a part of this television show and there was this great fashion attached to it, this great city, and there were these great cosmopolitans and there were these great bars,
right,
and it looked like the kind of life that people would want to live, especially, you know, people who were sitting there in their early 20s thinking, oh, I want to live in New York, I want to do this. And so the sex part was hip, too.
And off we went for 6 seasons. Jennifer Frey, Alice Kim, stand by. We're talking about Sex and the City. It's over. Was this all a glossy fantasy, or did it reflect changes in how we talk about sex? Join us. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Sex and the City and America's changing relationship with bold, independent women.
I finally agreed to listen to what he had to say, and
I've never known anyone like you, Samantha. I was in over my head. And I got scared.
He got scared? I get scared. I hide under the covers, not between somebody's legs.
Perhaps you had to be there.
Perhaps you're going to have to be there around the clock to make sure he doesn't get scared again.
6 seasons and Sex and the City is over. What do you think? Were you a Sex and the City addict? Was it good for you? What made you tune in? And now that it's over, what did it all mean? Was this all glossy fantasy, or did it reflect changes in how we talk about sex, about love, how we talk with each other. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Jennifer Fry, television reporter for The Washington Post, and from Santa Cruz, California, by L.S. Kim, assistant professor of film and digital media at University of California, Santa Cruz. You can join the conversation. Diana's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Diana. You're on the air.
Oh, whoa, I can't believe I'm on. I think some of my friends are going to be mad at me for saying this.
Uh-oh.
But I, you know, used to sit around and watch it with my girlfriends and had a great time. And I think especially during the first few seasons, there came a point where I just had to say, this isn't fun anymore. This is, it's kind of sad.
Because it was round and round and round.
Yeah, it was like, oh, more sex here, more sex there, this relationship there. And I just wanted them to do something. And it just felt like, especially listening to that earlier caller who was so young, this isn't anything to aspire to. These women, not that they were sad because they were single or because they had these lives, but they lived these very hedonistic, sex-oriented, fashion-oriented, relationship-oriented lives, and I got sick of it.
Diana, what did you want them to break out to?
I just wanted to see more aspects of their lives, and I guess maybe there weren't any more aspects of their lives. Maybe part of the exciting part of it was that it was set in New York and everybody wants to live there because it's so glamorous. But I don't know. I just wanted to see some real women talk about sex because to me, these just really weren't. It didn't represent me. It didn't represent who I wanted to be. I certainly don't want to go wear Prada in New York for the rest of my life. So I really had a hard time with that, and it made me sad.
Because there just wasn't enough there. Did it change for you later on? Did they try to get a little more meaty, a little deeper, a little further into the characters' lives?
I think so. I don't have HBO, so I had to rent it.
Right.
Maybe that's part of the reason I got sick of it. But I think so. During the last couple seasons, I think they did get, like you said earlier, more focused on their relationships with each other. And that was very interesting. But, you know,
Before they got there, you had about enough.
I just wanted something meatier.
Yeah, no, I understand exactly. Jennifer Fry, did you ever critique it that way? A year ago, were you saying, boy, they better have a good last season because this is getting old?
No, I don't think it was getting old. I think that they shifted the emphasis away from sex, 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 sex. I mean, yes, there was always sex in every episode, but away from it being about this glamorous life and sex into wanting relationships, wanting to not feel like you had to have a relationship if you were working. I think one of the things that was good about this show is that there are just a ton of cliches about single working women and what their lives are like or what their choices say about themselves. And the fact that these women, the show started and they were all already in their 30s or, you know, in Samantha's case, probably pushing 40 at that point was significant because it did work in all these other issues of, you know, Miranda and her 35-year-old lazy ovary panic, which is, you know, a subject that's on the cover of Newsweek. Don't think you can have a baby at 40.
Right.
And things like that. And so it explored a lot more of the issues that reflect stereotypes of women, single women, so single working women. And in that way, I found that aspect of the show to be very compelling. And I thought, you know, outside of the sex, you know, there was this issue of, you know, Miranda being a partner in a law firm and the guy who comes along is a bartender. And there's a social strata there. And there's this idea about women have been bettering themselves. They've become, you know, top wage earners. She owns her own apartment.
So can she marry down, quote unquote? Yeah.
Can she marry down the way men have married down for decades? And can she feel comfortable with that? And, you know, the exploration of issues like that are interesting because that does show how our traditional notions of male-female courtship and relationship and marriage and what roles different people play in it have changed. But women are still trying to figure out how their own place and where they move forward from that should be.
No kidding. Ellis Kim, let me ask you. I mean, these were professional women, and yet we almost never saw them work. They were independent women, and yet their conversations were heavily focused on men. Was this ultimately a feminist show or not?
Well, I think their conversations were heavily focused on the relationship that, or the influence that their relationships with men would have on their lives. So here we have in the closing season, Carrie, you know, giving up possibly giving up her life and her career in New York for a man. And hands down, that was not the right decision for her to make by the text, by the fans, and by Carrie's own standards. I think that, you know, in some ways, you asked the right question to the caller. What did she want to happen?
Yeah.
And because the program is all about the status of women who are not married or not dependent on marriage and don't expect marriage to be the end, right? The happy mm-hmm. ending. That we had to be in this place where there wasn't that trajectory.
And yet that is kind of where they all landed. I mean, by the last show last night. Essentially, they're not all married, but they're all headed toward steady, long-term relationships, it appears.
Right, it appears. We're not sure. And in some ways, it gets back to your question at the top of the hour, what about the ending? And I think in some ways, it doesn't matter how the series ended last night, because it's not over. We know, as you said, kind of the supertext will never end. It's going to be in syndication. The DVDs are available. There might be a film. The book or books are out there. But, you know, the questions about women and the role changing roles of women in society are unanswered and have no ending. And I think in that regard, the program, you know, is pro-feminist. It deals with these questions. I also wanted to add that, yes, Sex and the City is about a glossy fantasy, but it's also about a set of real conversations. And in some ways, all the talk about sex I see as a metaphor for the choices that women have. And as Rebecca
Dyck, what do you mean by that? Sex is not sex. Sex is a stand-in for something else.
I think sex can become a stand-in for the choices that women can or must make. And so that's why often their relationship talk really has consequences about their lives and their sense of who they are. And so we have this metaphor of many, many choices. Rebecca Dyck at Babes in Toyland might say, you know, the choices are endless. And so the series didn't end last evening because the questions remain unanswered.
Yeah. Esther's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Esther. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Good to have you.
So, I am of the demographic. I'm 39. I'm single.
You're smack dab in it.
I'm smack dab in it. And I wanted to maybe harken back to what a caller said earlier.
Yeah.
I didn't get hooked onto the show until it got me more meaty. I got kind of sick of it, like, okay, they sleep with everybody they meet. So what? What really drew me in was how you see their relationships develop, and I think, you know, my favorite shows were the ones where I was either laughing with them or crying with them. There's a show where Miranda's mother dies, and I felt like, you know, being of the demographic, I just felt like I was with my girlfriends, and I
like you were sitting at that coffee shop table.
Yes, definitely.
And that was a pretty good feeling because it was an open place, an honest place.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I do have those kinds of conversations with my friends. So, you know, I could really relate to these characters. I relate to Carrie, you know, so.
Everybody relates to somebody, but I know what you mean. When the relationships really bled over and beyond the sex anecdotes and the sex moments, I mean, those were fun, but the relationships were the thing that got you hooked in there, and I hear that. Esther, thanks very much for your call. Errol is calling from Sturbridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Errol. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
I'm actually from Cambridge, but I'm actually driving home, and I'm at a rest stop in Sturbridge.
Glad you pulled over.
Did I had to. I had no choice. Basically, the caller before the last caller mentioned, well, they both said it was getting tired, but I felt like it needed to be said because the society has made us believe that, okay, women are just fairy tale fantasy, love, 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 get married at 25. And I think it needed to get out there that they're single moms, divorced, so on and so forth, that still have a life and feel sexy and want to have sex. It's a good thing. You know what I mean? I really thought that it was a great show, and I enjoyed every episode. Haven't missed one.
Errol, we got it, and thank you for your call. Stay safe on the road. Jennifer, what was your sense of how men responded to this show? Did you ever see a breakdown on viewership? Were there more men than or women than men viewers?
There were by far more women than men viewers. It was definitely a women's demographic. Some men loved the show because they felt like they were getting a glimpse into the bathroom when the girls all get up to go together at the table, and they can never figure out why we have to be in there together and what is it exactly we're
the inside
about.
Story, yeah.
There was also, as that caller was just talking about, I mean, it's an old myth that we hope, you know, was exploded in the sexual revolution decades ago, but there still is a lingering sense that women don't enjoy sex as much or in the same way that men do. And I think that's one of the things that this show just wanted to blow right out of the water from the very beginning, that a woman could enjoy sex outside the realm of even a relationship for the pure physical pleasure of it. And that's not supposed to be something that women would feel or want. Like, you know, there's this, you know, traditional sort of joke about, oh, you know, she can have sex like a man, and having sex like a man means not needing someone to call you the next day. And I think that the show sort of flirted with those traditional notions of what sex means to women and what sex means to men. And it didn't go so far, obviously, as to say, you know, sex is meaningless. It showed all different levels of sex. In some situations, you know, women would be in intense relationships in the show, and sometimes Samantha would pick up a guy for one night and never see him again and not care.
And it was her choice.
And it was her choice, and she owned that choice, and she was not at all ashamed of that choice.
I guess not. Andrew's calling from Lakewood, Ohio. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. Unlike everybody else who has called, and that is to say, I'm not a fan only because I have never actually seen a single episode. I'm probably one of the last people in America who hasn't.
Okay.
However, I have seen the interesting rise of one of the cultural contributions to America from the show, which is the rise of the cosmopolitan.
the drink. As a waiter, you see people ordering it?
I wait tables for the past 4 years, and it has become the new white Zinfandel in America, which I'm all for, because, you know, if it's going to go from a $4 glass of wine up to an $8 cocktail, hey, you know, keep the show on for 3 more seasons.
And is it the women who are ordering the cosmopolitan, Andrew?
Pretty much. And the interesting phenomenon is you get a lot of the people, you'll have a table of 8 ladies going out to see a show or whatnot in downtown Cleveland, and one person will say, I'll have a Cosmo, and one person will say, well, what is a Cosmo? And the person will say, well, I saw that, that what they drink on Sex and the City. And you'll be like, oh, okay, I'll try one. And before you know it, it's a snowball effect. Everybody at the table has a full round, and our bartender's going crazy.
And the waiter's happy, and the bar's happy, and everybody goes off tipsy. Andrew, thank you very much for your call. So, Ellis Kim, look forward with us here. We may see more of Sex and the City in the theaters. There's talk that there'll be a movie to follow up on the show.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think that that HBO, that cable, will come back with something on this line? Is there a niche carved out here now that has to be filled, that kind of candor, that kind of openness? Is it now waiting for another vehicle of some kind?
Well, I mean, I think, as Jennifer said, as a cable program, HBO allowed for the program to say and show a lot of what it did. But I think if we look at the history of television, we have a slow, steady trajectory of representing women and representing women's stories. And so on one hand, you know, we broke a few thresholds. And on the other hand, it's part of a larger movement. I think Sex and the City has had great writing, incredible performances, clearly was successful in garnering such, you know, love and fandom, and that in that regard, it's unique and will remain unique.
And Jennifer, what do you think about these actresses? Should we look for them in other TV shows? Are they off to the movies? What's next for Sarah Jessica Parker, Cynthia Nixon, Kristen Davis, Kim Cattrall? Where are you looking for them?
Well, I do know that all four apparently seem to be on board or about to be on board for a major motion picture. It's not a done deal, but that seems to be the case. It was interesting to watch Sarah Jessica Parker's interviews evolve as it got closer and closer to the end of the show. She was the one who decided to call it quits. It was her call.
Right.
And, you know, she was, before this, the girl in Square Pegs and the nerdy one in Footloose and a couple of, you know, not-so-great grossing romantic comedies. And this made her an icon, and I think she began to realize as it ended, oh, my goodness, what do I do now? And she talked a lot about her new baby and her husband and being home with her family. And I'll be very curious to see whether or not they can break out
a lot of decisions to make
and move into something new.
Jennifer Frey, Ellis Kim, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.